You're listening to the MoneyWeb Now podcast series with Simon Brown. Live streamed every weekday at 6:30 a.m.
It's Monday, 16 September. We got Metrofile results due later today. I'm Simon Brown, coming at you live and loud from the MoneyWeb Global Headquarters in Johannesburg, South Africa. On the show today, chatting with Nkunzi Sanlam Private Wealth, it is interest rate cut week. FOMC, MPC and BOJ, although they're probably not going to cut. Barlow World and PGMs. We chat with PwC South Africa, their banking and capital markets partner, looking at H1 2024 banking results so far. And Tim Atkin, Master of Wine and Coach International Wine Challenge, the value of South African wines and how they stand up globally. This show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial services provider. Morning headlines from MoneyWeb, 96-month vehicle finance. Welcome to payment hell. We're now at the era of 30-year home loans and 4-year smartphone contracts. Business Day, Fitch leaves South Africa's rating unchanged, flags contentious NHI. Rating agency says the Government of National Unity has provided some certainty, but risks to political stability remain. Morning markets, US was green, S&P and NASDAQ up 0.5%. The East is mixed. We've got Sydney up 0.2%. 2%. Tokyo closed for respect of the aged day. Hong Kong down 0.2 and Tencent up 0.33%. Commodities mostly green. Gold all-time high at 2,614. Brent is red at 71.75. Platinum is $1,005 an ounce. Palladium 1,075. The rand is 17.70. Bitcoin 58,500. Top 40 opening call. Green open 85 points or 0.1% to the upside.
MoneyWeb Now on the money. Also available on podcast.
Chatting now with Nkunzi, Senior Portfolio Manager, Sanlam Private Wealth. Nick, appreciate the early morning. As I said in the intro, it has finally arrived. We have waited. Some folks were saying rate cuts in January. That seemed a bit optimistic, but it's been a while. FOMC Wednesday expected to cut. MPC Thursday expected to cut. BOG Friday might actually rise. What do we expect markets' response to be?
Yeah, morning, Simon. Yeah, it's a big one, as you said. It's a significant week for central banks and on both sides of the Atlantic and, of course, here in South Africa. So big, big decisions. I guess the question is, will there be rate cuts in that part of the world, but rather about how much. Mm-hmm. It looks like the market's got a little bit ahead of itself. Some people talking about 50 basis points by the Fed. But I suspect, they are sort of not going to change their habits. It's probably going to be a quarter point cut. But rate cuts are rate. We've hit the top of the rate cycle for now, anyway.
Yeah, and it's been a long wait, and we've seen it in results. We saw Growthpoint last week. I mean, the higher rates have hurt. It's going to take a bit of time for it to work its way through. But it is a significant tipping point that we've finally got to. Barlow World update on late on Friday afternoon, and they were under cautionary for something unrelated. This is that they were potentially selling stuff to Russia in breach of sanctions. I mean, they don't actually tell us much except that, I mean, they might be in trouble.
Yeah, it's a tricky one that when the news story broke that Sens dropped, I was thinking, no, this can't, they're having another Friday the 13th, so it can't be right. but when you sort of drill down, as you said, I mean, not too much detail on the Sens that we can deduct other than that, there are potential violations of U.S. sanctions. I will say this, that was voluntary disclosed. Yep. And I assume, there will be a bit of leniency because of that. But saying that, I mean, typically in the past, I mean, you sort of break these violations, it usually ends up being a fine, and it's usually a percentage of turnover. I mean, this is just a guess, I don't know, but I mean, it could be like 5% of turnover. Anyway, stock didn't like it, and it's a real sort of, flip of the coin, isn't it, Simon? As you said, I mean, at one point we're talking about corporate action and, someone sniffing around, and the next minute you get something like this. So I guess there's more clarity this week, but it was a little unnerving to get it sort of as late as we did on a Friday.
Yeah, and to your point, we just don't know. Do they get leniency because they came forward? We'll find out in time. PGMs, a wild week last week. I mean, the metal prices have moved. Were the stocks just bouncing off massively oversold, or are we brave enough to say the bottom is in?
Simon, you and I are old enough in this game to know who's going to call a bottom in these PGMs. I do think that there's usually a catalyst, and I think you've mentioned a couple of times, of your sort of speakers have mentioned it as well. I mean, you know, so you needed something. You know, you either need these minds to be mothballed, and, you know, which PGM guy is going to blink first and do it. But I think, you know, Sibanye is certainly coming out and saying they're going to cut production by 45% of their Sibanye, which is a massive platinum mine. You know, that was probably the start. And if I want to be really contrarian, you know, Anglo Platts selling at the absolute bottom of the cycle is probably a turning point. They never get it right, these the men sitting in the C-suite. But that might have been a turning point too. But as you said, I mean, really, really big bounce back. And I don't know if this is the bottom or not, but decent volumes. And it wasn't just the odd sort of counterbalancing. I mean, it was across the board and palladium. And also, we don't really see it much on the screen, Simon, but worth mentioning that rhodium also creeping up and hitting a half of the year, which I think also bodes pretty well, but I don't want to jinx it this morning.
No, I take your point. And I also was reminded last week by Wayne McCurry that Anglo American wanted to sell Kumba when it was at its absolute bottom and then decided against it. And rhodium actually back at 4,800 on my screens this morning. And weirdly, green year to date, 8.5% higher. Nick Kunze from Sunlam Private Wealth, appreciate the early morning time.
My name is Farzan Hassani. I'm the co-founder and CEO of the crypto exchange Valour. This week I'm on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast and exploring a somewhat philosophical subject. Is Bitcoin an instrument of freedom? And if so, what will that freedom look like? It's an important subject for all of us. We've got problems with our current financial system and society at large. Join us.
Don't forget, join me, Kieran Ryan, weekly on the MoneyWeb Crypto Podcast. Listen on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Yvonne Rupnarin, PwC South Africa Banking and Capital Markets Partner. Yvonne, appreciate the time today. The report that you published early Friday morning, looking at the banking sector, first half 24 versus 23. Two things really stood out for me. A lot of information, but two things stand out. The first was impairment charges, which came in at an average 1%. This down from 1.1 in the first half of 2023. And considering the consumer out there, I think is a really good number and shows that banks are, I suppose, being cautious in their lending, which is kind of what you want banks to be, more or less.
Absolutely, Simon. It's a pleasure to be with you. You're quite right. What you saw in our report is that the credit loss ratio combined for the four banks that we cover in our analysis has fallen to 100 basis points. Simon, I guess I would say this was driven by a combination of factors, some of which include credit models expecting an improved interest rate outlook in the short to medium term. We've previously commented on the interrelationship between interest rates and impairments. So in the previous period, you know, when interest rates were at the elevated levels that they were at, and there was uncertainty around when they might fall, you saw the higher credit loss ratio. I think the other thing you see in credit impairment charges is that some longstanding non-performing loans, particularly in the corporate and investment banking businesses of our major banks, have been worked out or restructured. That helps the credit loss ratio. And then thirdly, I think it's fair to say there are improved credit trends in South Africa, particularly towards the second half of the first half of the year in retail banking. And you saw slower inflows into loan portfolios that the bank calls early arrears. And that was really as a result of some proactive customer assistance programs, enhanced collection strategies, and so on that were implemented by the banks.
Gotcha. Okay, that makes perfect sense. The other number that stood out for me was the cost to income. They're targeting 50%. They didn't meet that. We understand there's been inflationary pressure and the like. 50% is an ambitious target. I mean, is there a worry about that edging higher? Is 50% an achievable number in your mind in the short to medium term?
Simon, I think it is. And let's remember that for this period, consumer price inflation in South Africa was at 5.1% at the end of June. It's come down a little bit since then. And it was higher than that for most of the first 6 months. Now, if you consider some of the key countries where these major banks operate outside South Africa, inflation was actually much higher than that. Countries like Ghana, Nigeria, Angola, and so on. So clearly, these results come in the context of an elevated inflationary environment. But with that as context, we did see the cost-to-income ratio ticking up moderately. If you think about where it was a year ago, 51.5% in June 23, I think that tells you 50% is achievable and within sight, notwithstanding elevated inflation levels. What's driving expenses? It is really the things that are aligned to the bank's strategic visions, things like investing in cloud-based software, investing in security costs, digitizing customer experiences on the front end, digitizing the back offices to make things more efficient. So efficiency is clearly on the mind of management teams.
And putting money in now, which the benefits will accrue down the line. And I hadn't thought of Africa, and it was going to be my next question, because what we are seeing is that the rest of the continent is proving fruitful for the banks. We see a lot of other sort of retailers and the like try Africa. It hasn't worked. The banks are doing all right over there.
Simon, they absolutely are. And look, sub-Saharan Africa outside of South Africa is growing relatively faster than the rates we see in South Africa. Mm-hmm. There really continues to be an intense strategic focus on the part of the banks on their operations in the rest of Africa. And that gives them strong levels of diversity to their overall performance. The scale and competitiveness of their operations in some high-growth markets has really emerged as an area of distinction, I think, for many South African banks, mm-hmm. in some cases making contributions north of 40% to overall group earnings. On the other hand, Africa is nuanced. As you mentioned, doing business on the continent can be difficult. There are both significant opportunities and there are some risks. And so you see the major banks balancing market-specific and sovereign risks with group-wide efficiencies to try to make the most of their African operations.
Yeah, I take your point. There's a lot of nuance into the rest of the continent. Whenever I see bank results, one of the things I go to is Common Equity Tier 1 Capital Ratio. A bit of a mouthful there. It's almost, with respect to the banks, become a boring thing to look at because they're all very comfortably within the requirements. Our banks are well capitalized, and it's an old phrase, but our banks are solid and they really are a pillar to our economy.
That is indeed true, Simon. And I think that's been a long-standing feature of the South African banking system. Our banks are well capitalized. They are liquid, well above regulatory minimum levels. Mm. And I think what you see in this results period, notwithstanding a difficult context, is really resilience. Resilience in the balance sheet, resilience in the momentum of their franchises, which translates into resilience in earnings growth.
Return on equity, a little bit lower, still above cost of capital. My sense is that all the banks with results that came out during the period, the big four, they're all looking to get that return on equity a little bit higher. And I suppose most CEOs the world over are looking at that. My sense is that our banks probably can push that ROE up in the years ahead.
Certainly. And I think the management teams have been clear on that in their results presentation. I think the one thing that one needs to look at the ROE in this period through the context of is that, and we spoke about Africa a moment ago, these African operations make sizable contributions to returns. And in this period, what you saw is quite a bit of significant currency volatility. You saw the devaluation of the Naira, as well as the Kwanza in Angola. And so what that means is that this volatility results in major banks' earnings being somewhat depressed because of the foreign currency translation effect when you report in rand. So I think that is one of the factors that is probably dampening ROE in this period. But underlying franchise momentum of these banks is certainly clear in these results.
If we look forward, and maybe a longer term look forward, almost as I'm chatting with you now, looking at our economy, we've got good prospects in the years ahead, but our banks are almost going to become continental banks rather than just sort of southern or maybe SADC banks.
Simon, I think it varies, and each institution will have their own set of strategic focus areas. They'll have their own aspirations about how to consolidate, how to acquire, how to look for opportunities. So there's possibly that, but I think the African continent is vast enough, has got enough sizable opportunities for each of them to work out the most appropriate strategy that works for them.
Yeah, I take your point. There are nuances as you look into the four of them, and it goes to nuances in the continent, but nuances in their strategies. We'll leave that there. Rivon Rubnarain, PwC South African Banking Capital Markets Partner, really appreciate the time.
And that's our poll today. How do you think the banks did in the first half of the year? We're talking the big banks here. Your take, were they good? Were they fair? Do they need to try harder? Have your vote. Have your say. LinkedIn and Twitter.
The Property Pod.
The South African Property Owners Association convention took place at Sun City last week, with the who's who of the country's commercial property sector gathered for SOPOA's flagship annual event. The Property Pod was there, and in this week's episode on MoneyWeb, we feature three executives who were at the convention, including SOPOA CEO Neil Gopal, Durban Chamber CEO Palisa Pili, and newly appointed SOPOA President Itumeleng Motibeli.
The Property Pod.
MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.
MoneyWeb now, on the money.
I'm chatting with Tim Atkin. He's a master of wine and co-chair of the International Wine Challenge. And truthfully, Tim, appreciate the time. I'm bearing the lead. There's a ton more else that you are. But the key point is you were down in Cape Town just last week. This 2024 South Africa Wine Report, it is a monster document, what, 300 plus pages. It suggests to me that whilst you are UK-based, you're seeing a lot in South African wine.
I do. I mean, I spend a lot of time there, and many people know I'm married to one as well, although I met her in the UK. I go to South Africa 3 times a year, so it's a big part of my life, really, and it's an exciting part of my life. I really am very enthusiastic about the South African wine scene at the moment.
Is it price? Is it quality? Is it a blend of both? I mean, as a South African, I think we've got brilliant wine at amazing prices, but truthfully, that's pretty much all I drink, so I'm not a fair comment.
Yeah, I think it's a very good point. I think it's both. I think it's price and it's also quality. To be honest, I think some of the cheap stuff is almost too cheap. And I say in the report that I think, you know, South Africa needs to up its average price point for reasons of sustainability, both economic sustainability, but also talking from a personal point of view, really, you know, how you treat your labour and how you reinvest basically in your vineyards. I think the top end, by top end, I mean really anything between 150 rand and above. I mean, it's considered premium in South Africa. If you think that the average price of a bottle of wine is probably 50 rand in South Africa, 150 to 300 rand, so which would in the UK end up being an equivalent of sort of 15 to 30 pounds, I suppose, by the time you pay duty and all those sorts of things. South Africa outperforms almost any country in the world. The very top stuff, which is above 300 rand, I think is a steal. I mean, there are a few wines that are slightly stupidly priced at 2,000 rand a bottle or stuff like that. But I think if you've got 300 rand in your pocket, you can buy some really outstanding stuff.
You're obviously appreciating it. You're obviously singing the stories of it. I mean, are wine drinkers, if I'm in a nice restaurant in London or Paris or New York or Beijing, are South African wines on the menu?
Do you know what? I mean, not enough, I think. I mean, I think it's one of those things that baffles me slightly, because I think in terms of the quality in the bottle and the price you pay for them, they're as good as any country in the world and possibly better value, actually. Has the message got through? It has a little bit in London. It has a bit in Holland. Again, I think for historic reasons, the connection between Holland and the Cape. Places like the States, I think really it's slightly struggling. And definitely if you go to China, you know, Beijing, I think it's rare you would see South African wine. I mean, there are a few wineries doing a good job there, but I don't know, what do we do? I mean, I think we need to get the message out more, and it's kind of down to all of us, you know, you South Africans and me as somebody who loves the wines, to talk more and more about them, because I think that the wines are not sufficiently appreciated.
It is. I mean, you know, again, when you think wine, we've got some big estates, we've got some well-known estates in South Africa, but my sense is we've got a lot of sort of more boutiques, smaller estates that are also producing really top-notch and kind of taking it to the big established estates.
Yeah, and I think it's not really necessarily a question of size. I mean, you've said that, really. I think that there's some very good large estates, you know, Canonkop being a very good example, that's making fantastic wines. I mean, Mielas is reasonably sizable in terms of the production of something like Rubicon. But you know, there are also wines, you know, David and Nardi, the Ibn Sardis, the Chris Alhites, who are making bottlings of, you know, 1,000 bottles of wine, really, you know, tiny little things. And I think the industry needs both. But I think your point is a good one, in the sense that what South Africa needs more of would be some bigger brands, you know, a sort of Penfolds type thing. I mean, Penfolds is obviously Australian, but to get the message out, you know, a bit like the Chocolate Block, like Cadet, like Classique from Rupert and Rothschild. I think if we had 20 of those as opposed to 3 or 4, it would be a good thing for the industry, that there aren't enough wines of volume that are internationally distributed.
I get your point. We sort of need that beachhead into the industry, and then everyone can.
I think we do, because very few people begin by drinking a country's wines, you know, drinking, sort of taking a chance on something that's quite expensive and of which there are 1,000 bottles produced.
Yeah.
I think they could like the idea of something being a brand, and they have the reassurance of a brand, and it could be a, you know, Rupert and Rothschild or a Burgundy's Kloof or a Canonkop, as I said, where people think, oh, I've probably heard of that. And therefore, you know, I don't mind spending 245 rand on a bottle. Mm-hmm. I think asking somebody to spend sort of 500 rand on a Paardeberg Chenin Blanc or something that they've never heard of is a tougher ask, really.
Yeah, I take your point. If we look more globally, how is wine drinking? And I ask it because, you know, beer drinking's under pressure. People are moving to ready to drinks. They're drinking cider. We've suddenly got the Japanese and the Thais making whiskey. How is wine drinking as a global alcoholic beverage?
I mean, not good, to be honest. I mean, I think it's in decline. I mean, I suppose the question is, are people going to drink less but better, or are they just going to drink less? Mm-hmm. And I think that younger people, by that I mean people in their 20s and late teens who are coming into wine now, I think they're drinking less wine. One thing that's interesting, and I do mention this in the report, is I think that those consumers have kind of different ethical standards, really. And I think they might be prepared to pay more for wines that have a story, they feel have a sustainable footprint, if you want to call it the term in that way. And I think they're prepared to pay a little bit more for something that they think it has ethical value. I mean, you know, I have no proof for that, but it's just stuff I read and it's anecdotal, really, from talking to kids or friends of mine. So I mean, I think that's kind of our hope, is that the young generation will favour wines with a story and with a backstory as well, and that they will spend a bit more on the wines they want to drink. It won't just be about value, you know, sheer value for money, nothing else. I think that's, it's the unknowable in a sense, but I think globally wine consumption is down, and it's sad for me because I love wine, but you know, it's true.
Yep, sad for me too, but I take your point. The new generation, they're coming through. Every generation is a different and has a different trend. Hopefully wine,
I think so, this. You know, I mean, I've no idea how old you are, but you know, I certainly think my generation has a different set of values from, you know, people in their 40s and certainly people in their 20s. I think they just look at wine and probably alcohol in a different way. And, you know, I mean, I don't know, who knows, maybe they're more interested in RTDs, as you said, or not drinking at all, or marijuana, you know, I mean, whatever, really. I don't know. I think all these things are part of the mix.
Yep, I take your point. I'm old enough to meet with Tussenberg when I was a student, which really dates me, but we'll leave it there.
I know the feeling.
That's Tim Aitken. He's a master wine coach, International Wine Challenge. You find him at timaitken.com. Appreciate the time. That's it for today. I was chatting with Skulk Low on Friday, again, about PGMs. We were in the middle of a two-day strong bounce. We asked you if it was time to buy PGM miners. It was evenly split between not yet and yes, nibbling, and already all in. This show is brought to you by Stanlib. Visit stanlib.com to get in touch with one of their investment specialists. Stanlib Asset Management is an authorized financial service provider. We're live every weekday morning. The MoneyWeb website's in the app, 6:30 a.m. Podcast just after 7. Thanks to my team, Eddie, Nobuchli, and Nicole, to you for listening, my guests for their time. My name is Simon Brown. This is MoneyWeb Now. We'll chat again tomorrow, FNB.
You've been listening to another MoneyWeb Now podcast, posted every weekday at 7 a.m. on moneyweb.co.za. MoneyWeb Now, on the money.